Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. This week, we continue with part two of our coverage of LA Commotion, the urban mobility conference recently held in California. And there's lots of good stuff on The Urbanist's road ahead. And once again, I'm joined by our America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker. We'll even get a ride in a driverless vehicle.
Well, this is about as quickly as you go in LA traffic anyway.
We speak with Montreal's lively mayor, Valerie Plante, who doesn't own a car, about her bold public transport plans for the city. And we'll hear from Estonia's Minister of Economic Affairs and Infrastructure about what makes her nation such a mobility ideas mover. Join us over the next 30 minutes as we whiz to the future. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck, and Ed Stocker, our America's editor-at-large. So welcome to this week's programme. First up, Valerie Plante. The Montreal mayor is on a mission to make transport, as she calls it, sexy. She argues that we need to start looking at it in a different way, namely as an engine for change and development. And it's all wrapped up in Canada's bold environmental goals.
For me, every time we think about public transport is an opportunity to think about social development. Are we doing, for example, a new bus line or a metro station in an area where it's really dense, or maybe from a socioeconomic, it's less diversified? So it opens up opportunities. And economically, of course, because for obvious reason, like, you know, traffic jam costs a lot of money for cities. But also when you build public transport, it's good. It creates jobs. And then when you know that your population is mobile, it is really good for the economy. And finally, for the environment, I have very bold objectives, is to be a carbon neutral by 2050 and zero waste by 2030. And that means for Montreal to go strong on public transport, because this is where we're at for Canada, for Quebec, for Montreal. It's not so much about doing the change for a better source of energy, because we have hydroelectricity. So the only way to reach our goals is through transport.
Some cities like London and New York are seeing drops in public transport ridership, I think largely because of rideshare. How do you sort of tackle that issue, and how do you work with the rideshares? How do you battle against a potential drop like that?
That is such a good question, because as we create more public transport options, it has to be accessible both physically and financially, right? So if it's not accessible financially, then we're missing the whole point. And this is where we need to work with our governments and making sure that we have, for example, social fares, that it's cheaper for different types of population, for students or maybe for elders. And this is discussion that we're having in Montreal with the government of Quebec. And I would say there is a will to make sure that everybody can take the metro. And for me, I feel like it will be a success when everybody takes the metro, whatever you're rich or not rich, or you're an elder, you're a student, you're young, whatever, what is your background, you want to take the metro or the bus, because it is, again, accessible, it's comfortable and quick.
And what's the secret for curbing vehicle use in Montreal? Is it high taxation? Is it cheap transport? What's the golden ticket?
Well, I wish we had a golden ticket. I would love that. But there was no major investment into the public transport sector. And since I took office, this is a priority for me. So now we just, for example, bought 300 hybrid buses. We're fighting for two new metro lines and you know, other options. And so now the question of money is being raised. And it makes sense. And now we need to diversify our sources of financing. And that means bringing the other level of government into the mobility change. And it is not an easy one, where in Quebec, for example, all taxpayers pay for the highways, where for public transport it's about 70%. So there's always a 20 to 25% that is being paid by the locals, which I think is absurd. We shouldn't be all paying for highways. And if we do that, we should be all paying as well for public transport options. So there is many conversation that needs to happen. In Montreal, we're lucky because our public transport system has been there for a while and people are used to love it. they're attached to it, but there's not an easy way. And for personally, as mayor, though I'm open to different types of taxation, it's a conversation that needs to happen with a different level of government, because again, it cannot be solely the responsibility of a mayor.
You also mentioned earlier today this idea of healthy living. How does that work with public transport on a day-to-day level?
It works all together, where my hope and what I think we should be leading towards is to have, for example, a family living in an apartment building or having a small house downtown, and the kids can go to school walking because of sidewalks, or biking because it's safe. And then you, the parents, you know, jump in the metro station that is just downstairs, and so they don't have to use a car, they're not stuck in traffic. And then, you know, they can easily go from home to work and come back and spend more time with their family in the public spaces and parks and stuff like that. And to me, this is really the vision for the future. We need to minimize urban sprawl. We need to make sure, if we want to save the planet and make sure the environment is following, is, you know, it's about density and having healthy cities, and healthy means a lot of mobility options. Public transport is one, but also the car sharing, bike sharing as well, which we have in Montreal. It's like a cocktail, right? So I'm back to a sexiness of transport. Well, we need to have a cocktail, a mobility cocktail.
I'll drink that.
That was Montreal's mayor, Valerie Plante, speaking to Ed. Gabriela Gomez Mont has been head of Mexico City's Laboratorio para la Ciudad, or LAB, for the city since its inception in 2013. Part think tank and part experimental arm, it's looked to problem solve everything from mobility to governance. She talks about fixing Mexico City and the lab's future.
Mexico City has the largest fleet of cabs in the world. And the tariffs are also some of the lowest in the world as well. So this is actually a vulnerable population. We're talking about 100,000 cabs plus 30,000 what we call pirate cabs, that are pretend cabs with pretend license plates.
Which you may not want to get in at night.
Which you might not want to get in at night, and which government doesn't usually like when I'm so publicly blunt about this fact, but it is an issue. And it's actually one of the reasons why Uber was so successful in its entry in Mexico City. So it is a vulnerable population. And for me, the reason that I asked the mayor if we could get involved was because I felt that, first of all, there was a social conversation that was becoming completely exacerbated, that suddenly we were throwing stereotypes back and forth. And I do think that one of the big things that Mexico City has to contend with still is with social stereotypes and these huge social divides that exist. So, you know, everybody, part of Mexico City was saying, yes, but, you know, cab drivers are rapists and murderers and dirty and this and that, and wrapping their bodies around the contemporaneous of the Uber flag and willing to self-emulate. No, and I think both of those positions are unwarranted. Whereas the cab drivers, I think, were asking the government to be very paternalistic when there are huge deficiencies right now in the quality of the service. And I do think that, you know, we need to keep an eye open to the benefits of innovation, technology and such. So I asked the mayor if we could basically try to create a citywide conversation, if not have a easy conversation, at the very least have it be a lot more productive. So basically what we did was, first of all, gather all of the news around this and demystify a lot of the fake news that was getting thrown around. Everything from quite silly to saying that the mayor was going to have the Uber cars paint in pink in the same way as the cab drivers, to much more serious stuff, such as that, you know, it was given that if you stepped into a cab, you were going to get murdered or raped, which is actually not true. Like, the crime rate has gone down in the last 10 years. So we created a space, like a single space, where we had every information available. And we had facts that pointed to the sources of what was actually, what are the discussions point, and not trying to water down what a difficult conversation it was in many ways, that we really needed to think about the type of city that we want and how do we contend with the paradox involved in having such a diverse society. Mexico City is quite unique in terms of, let's say, in New York, because in New York, I get why the amount of cars that are being put on roads is not healthy, and that New York really has to approach this in a very different way. The thing for Mexico City is that since at that point in time, you needed to pay with a smartphone and with a credit card, that actually reduces the population to about 3 million people. And so we had new types of drivers, like people that would not use public transportation at all, many of them that wouldn't even get into a cab, were usually using Uber. So I'll give you one example. In affluent societies in Mexico City, you'll send the driver from you know, far away to pick up the kids at the private school, and then the driver goes up. And suddenly you have mothers sending Uber cars, which is half the trajectory. Or you have, let's say, after a party, kids sharing cars instead of each taking their own car or having their drivers ride them. So we started seeing very different mobility patterns in terms of the use of Uber, and that people that don't use their private car are obviously a lot more willing to use a mixed modality. And it wasn't necessarily people from public transportation suddenly getting on Ubers. So they create a competition between what we call taxis de sitio, which are location taxis, but not with the cabs on the road, and definitely not with public transportation. It's a completely different type of user. That said, one of the recommendations that came out is that we need to work on dynamic regulation. We need to know that things are not fixed in time, and especially when new services are just coming into cities, that what is true right now might not be true in a year or 2 years or 3 years. So how do we keep our eyes open as government to know how to understand the externalities and when we need to come in and when we just let companies run loose? Because I do think that there's a big conversation to be had around when a new service comes in that is taking the place of a public service. Is it making governance capacity stronger, or is it taking them away? And I think in places such as San Francisco, where we've seen that public transportation has been really hit by private options, we cannot be dependent on private companies to be looking out for the public good. They are looking out for their stakeholders, and we have to understand that as government. We cannot be naive. So does something increment or decrease governance capacity? And how do we actually make every private player coming in and taking the place of a public service, or serving the masses, if you will, how do we really keep an eye out on that not getting out of hand and then creating a very dystopic future in the medium term?
That was Gabriela Gomez-Mont. Now, hot on the heels of our LA road trip last week, that's me and Ed, we were on very manly e-scooters in case you missed it. This week, we hop in the back seat of a self-driving car to learn more about the tech. Over to Kendra Gallup from Autonomous Stuff to explain more.
I'm Kendra Gallup, a business development manager at Autonomous Stuff. Autonomous Stuff provides research development vehicles to enable our customers to reach autonomy faster. And now, feel free to take a ride with your autonomy guide, Cameron.
This is brave stuff, isn't it? We're going to get into an autonomous vehicle. We're both virgins on this run.
We are.
And we're going to see what it's all about. I've got a feeling we're not going to be racing around the city. We're in a very contained zone, and I think at best we're going to go in a loop. But let's see what it's all about.
We're going to do some backseat driving, I think.
Yeah, we're going to be in the back and see how this little vehicle moves on its own.
This is GPS path following, basically. So a few minutes ago, I just drove this little route around the lot here. And now, basically, I'll hit engage, and it'll basically just put itself into the mode. And with this software, say if I wanted to make a campus shuttle or something like this, I could very easily drive some route, drop in stop signs, speed limits for different sections of the route, and it would just faithfully follow that path, provided it had GPS reception. So this is a, I don't want to say it's a parlor trick, but in the world of autonomy, it's relatively basic to have it follow a path like this, but the way it steers through that path is the tricky part.
We're off, Andrew.
Nice and gently. I think how many miles per hour are we going at this point?
More like three.
Okay. It's going to take us a while to get to the airport.
Yeah. Well,
well, this is about as quickly as you go in LA traffic anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a little bit clearer as well.
So this isn't autonomy. I mean, really, the true, if you're going to go to the airport, for instance, right, you wouldn't even use a map like this. You would use an HD map, which is made with the LiDAR.
Will car companies or providers have to do all that mapping of the roads?
This is already happening. Today, there are fleets of vehicles running around every city in the US making maps with LiDAR, radar cameras. If you wanted to buy an HD map of the entire state of California today, it cost about $22 million. So there's a huge prize in just doing HD maps. So that's one piece of the business. And then you've got to basically make sure that your map is updated and ready to go. So I'm going to just stop right here.
So what's your prediction when, because you know, we see tests and we see modest examples of it, but when it becomes every day.
The first applications are going to be rideshare services on private property campuses. But you can go to Germany right now and buy an Audi A8 that will go park itself after you get to the restaurant. So we're slowly getting there, but I think it'll happen in a way where you won't even really feel it. You know, you'll just get on a bus at the airport one day and go, oh, there's nobody driving it. So I think adoption will happen faster, but in ways people don't really think about. Fun stuff.
Thank you.
Estonia has become a bit of a poster child for clever thinking around mobility, not as a manufacturer, but rather as a nation willing to legislate to ensure that change happens. How about free bus travel for everyone, or delivery robots and driverless vehicle testing? Kadri Simpson is the nation's Minister of Economic Affairs and Infrastructure, and she was in LA to spread the mobility gospel, according to Tallinn, and we caught up with her.
In Estonia, the public transport has been a very heated topic, and we have made significant changes in our transport lines. But at the same time, we are working on demand-based public transport. And that's why I thought that I will get some bright ideas how to solve transport issues back home. And at the same time, I was willing to share our experience, what has happened with the numbers of users after we introduced free public transport in our country.
You say you're here to learn some lessons, and just that very point, I think that the world looks at Estonia, this extraordinary experiment which started within Tallinn and has now been rolled out across the countryside. Is all public transport effectively now free in the country?
No, only local passes are free for everyone. So they are free every day, each day, and for everyone, even for tourists. But at the same time, if you are taking a train or if you are taking ferry to go to our islands, then you still have to pay. But also the ferries, local flights and trains, they are heavily subsidized. So Estonia is land-wise not so small country, but we have very few inhabitants. And that means that in countryside, there are not so many passengers and we can't run public transport without subsidies.
And the reasons for the experiment, is it purely environmental or was it a social experiment as well to try and get everybody to share the same spaces? What was the thinking behind giving free transport?
Behind it were different arguments. First of all, we have always had local transport all around the country. But each year, the numbers of passengers were declining. And that meant that if there are fewer travelers, the lines were optimized, there were fewer options, and lesser passengers again. So we decided that if we want to have a good transport network, a bus route network, then we need to attract more passengers. And we made a survey, and one of the top reasons was that there is no difference if I'm buying a bus ticket or if I'm sharing a private car with some neighbors, for example. First of all, we wanted to attract more passengers to public transport. Another reason was that our parliament adopted energy targets. And by 2030, we have promised that we will use in transport as much fossil fuels than we used in 2011. And at the same time, our inhabitants, they are becoming wealthier and wealthier, and a lot of them would prefer to buy a new car. And they tend to be combustion engine cars, not electric ones. So again, to make public transport somehow more attractive, we decided to make it ticket-free.
And tell me, when you come here to share ideas, it's fascinating seeing all these new scooter technologies and driverless vehicles, for example. But is that something that you can bring back to Tallinn, or do you think that you have very specific needs in a very specific society that's letting you follow a slightly different model for how to get people moving around the city?
Well, last year we were fulfilling the position of presidency of the European Union. And during our presidency session, the driverless buses were operating in Tallinn. And we have adopted a law that allows testing of driverless vehicles everywhere in our streets. And actually, in our traffic, there are parcel robots that are delivering goods already. So 2 years ago, we had first traffic accident when car was hitting parcel robot. And there was already existing law that helped us to solve this incident. And fault was drivers, not robots. And of course, our traffic is pretty smooth. So, and we have special lines for public transport. So introducing driverless buses, it is possible in the near future.
So you want the city to be a laboratory for potential change?
Yes, and we are not afraid of experimenting. We have done it in different fields, and our public is not afraid of this kind of innovation.
And what happened to the robot?
Well, it needed a little bit of repair because it has several sensors and cameras, but robots are still active in our streets.
That was Kadri Simpson, the nation's Minister of Economic Affairs and Infrastructure, talking to me at LA Commotion. William Chernikov works at the Toyota Mobility Foundation as a senior manager for global research and innovation. He's the kind of guy you imagine waking up at night with a bright idea, and perhaps the odd transport worry too, because the tasks ahead are big and complex. The switch over to electric vehicles, how they'll be charged, the ways in which we'll use transport. Is the future positive, and are we going too slow? You can see why he has a lot to contemplate. I asked Chernikov some very basic questions, and he shared his rather wiser answers.
When we talk about electric vehicles, we talk about electric drive. And that is both battery electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, but also fuel cell vehicles. As you note, a lot of the issues are around infrastructure. There's the vehicles, which we have to get into the hands of the public, but they have to be able to use them in a way that provides the utility that they expect now, whether they're privately owned vehicles or shared vehicles or providing services such as taxis or cabs. The infrastructure, there's an expense to it. How do we get clean energy to the infrastructure? If we're really trying to solve the environment and climate and sustainability issues, we can change the fuel, but more to the point, we have to do so in a way that actually adds the strategic long-term value. And these are complex systems. There's costs associated with it, there's accessibility, and there's transition times. And how do we do so in a way that is equitable and accessible to all segments of the society?
Who is the we that is meant to be paying for this infrastructure? Do you believe that is a coalition of the manufacturers of the vehicles and the civic authorities, or do you believe it's down to government and local councils to be footing that bill?
That's a very good question, and I think there's a lot of debate around that. I don't know that there's one clear answer. You can argue that all of those entities have a role to play. If we truly want to make it sustainable, government can play a role in facilitating the transition, but the real value comes in creating the sustainable business economic opportunity. So at some point we have to create the marketplace and the conditions that enable the private sector to provide the infrastructure and run it and maintain it and do so in a way that meets their expectations, but also provides the service at a cost-effective, reliable way to the consumer and the public.
Now, we're here in Los Angeles because this city is doing lots of pioneering work and it's opening itself up as a laboratory. But when you look at cities that you've visited and looked at the work that they're doing, are there any benchmarks for success or any cities that you think are beginning to get it right?
We work with a lot of cities and they're all facing different challenges. Certainly one of the advantages of working with a city like LA is they have some really very capable people here on the city side, as well as some support from the policy side at the state level. It's an entry. And I don't know how many bins there are, but certainly as we want to progress to the 7 billion plus people that exist and live on this planet globally and are growing, we have to start with where we can get those low-hanging fruit, where the opportunity is. But we also spend a lot of time trying to understand how can we take the lessons that we learn here, given the unique attributes of an LA, and what does it mean for how it might port over to other cities? There's limits to that, but it's a start. And things that may not work here, where the appearance is that it's easier to make it work here, but there's still challenges, well, those are the areas where we can apply the research, the learning, try to find areas for improvement, and then go to the next level and the next level.
And tell me, the foundation, what does it see as its job and what do you see as your job in this debate and in this process of change?
So we are one part of a massive complex system where we play as the foundation. We are a nonprofit. So our motivation, the way we can integrate, there's some advantages for governments maybe working with us to solve some of these problems. Some of that may be on some of these overarching rules. How do we govern the commons? How do we create the framework for the transition and the rules that doesn't favor one pathway or one entity over another, but provides this perspective on equity and access and enhances the capability of the governance side. We are also able to come in, and yes, as a foundation, we provide financial support. We also provide some technical know-how and some partnership and management capacity building. We can also serve as a conduit to bring in different technologies. Transformation takes time, but it usually starts with finding a problem, bringing the right solution to bear, bringing the right partners together in a way that over a period of time, anywhere from months to maybe a few years, we can implement a solution, tune it, adjust it, and then leave it in capable hands so that we can then replicate and expand or focus on the next problem. We are not going to solve this ourselves, but through the projects we've done, we are starting to build and add that capacity for these grassroots solutions that are starting to transform mobility in cities across the globe.
That was William Chernikov of the Toyota Mobility Foundation. Okay, so you've had 2 weeks of our mobility meetings at LA Commotion, and perhaps it's a moment to reflect on the mood at the conference and what does lie ahead. LA proved to be a great city to host the event because, as we heard in last week's show from James Sanders at Architects Woods Bagot, the city is ripe for change, and its mayor, Eric Garcetti, is up for all sorts of experiments and is putting money behind transformational projects. So the buzz was positive, but there was also a sense that this was cutthroat California at play and that many of the young innovators with clever ideas are likely to lose out to bigger players. And the other word of caution is that too many of the fun ideas on display, there were rather a lot of e-scooters and motorized skateboards, are products with a tiny prospective audience. Not everyone is a hipster guy. So there's still a long way to go for LA and the world, and just getting an Uber ride to the future is not enough. But there were a lot of clever people there hoping to chart the way, and let's give them a chance. That's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and it was edited by David Stevens. And our thanks, of course, to Ed Stocker, too. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's The Midnight with Los Angeles. Thank you for listening, city lovers.